It's a great honour and a great privilege to be able to talk about these things in this very particular and very special context, this very special institution, which was Sigmund Freud's, as he said, last address on Earth, where he lived between 1938 and his death in 1939, and surrounded by the things which mattered so much to him. I should start with a couple of disclaimers. I'm not a specialist in the history of Freud, and certainly not in Freud's thought, but I've become increasingly fascinated over the years and over repeated visits to this institution by the intersection between Freud, one of the towering figures of 20th century thought, 19th and 20th century thought, and my own field, which is the study of the art in China. And I've always had an interest in the history of collecting of Chinese art. Now, Freud's passion for antiquities is well known, and there's a wonderful kind of thing here that I have here on the screen, Max Pollack's famous engraving of Sigmund Freud at his desk. And here it is. Here's Freud's actual copy of it. So I'm kind of standing between these two. This is an often reproduced image, and one which stands in the literature for Freud's well-known and now much studied great passion for antiquities, and a very, very large collection of art objects of the ancient world, gathered over almost the full course of his life. And as I say, been much discussed in the literature, but I feel that there's been curiously little about the Chinese part of the collection, particularly about objects which I will try to argue were particularly important to Freud, and which were literally staring him in the face as he sat at his desk, and which were so liberally scattered around both his Viennese home, Berggasse 19, where he lived from 1891 to 1938, and also scattered around here in Maresfield Gardens in the last couple of years of his life. So that if we look at one of the photographs taken by Venice photographs taken by Edmund Engelmann, these were taken in 1938 as records of Freud's living and working space prior to his leaving Austria, fleeing from the Nazis. In 1938, really to record what that house had looked like. And these photographs, of course, were very much used in recreating Freud's environment for him here in London. And we will see among the many, many artworks and objects I've just circled for you, just to kind of give us a sense of what I'm going to be talking about. There is one of Freud's Chinese antiquities, a terracotta horse, very prominent in the complete ensemble of things. And there, again, a famous photograph of Freud actually at his desk in Vienna, and we see another horse and another camel behind him, and this famous kind of dense ensemble of objects right in front of his line of vision on his desk. And that's what was recreated very much here, and which what you can see downstairs in Freud's study. And I should say that accounts of Freud at work and in his study suggest that his engagement with these things was not purely visual. These were things he picked up, these were things he handled. There's a lot of accounts of him handling and touching and passing around the things in his collection. We have a pretty clear sense among all of these objects, and there are about 2,000 objects in Freud's collection, we have a pretty clear sense. He was quite explicit about what his favourite object was. His favourite object, the thing that meant the most to him, or out of all of them, was this bronze Roman figure of the goddess Athena, goddess of wisdom. And it's hardly surprising something from Greco-Roman antiquity, which meant so much to Freud, and from which he derived so many of the kind of models for thinking about the human mind and about human culture, this sort of isn't really that surprising. And we know that this object mattered a very great deal to him, because we know that in 1938, when the Nazis had already taken control of Vienna, and Freud and his immediate family were negotiating to leave Vienna, and were hoping to take their collection with them, it wasn't clear that this would be successful. It wasn't clear that even if he and his immediate family could get out of Vienna, it wasn't clear that the things themselves were going to be able to accompany him. So we know that one of his very close friends and confidants, French psychoanalyst, she'd been a patient of his, Princess Marie Bonaparte. Marie Bonaparte actually smuggled this object out of the apartment in her handbag, so that the one very, very favourite object would be available to Freud. Even if he lost everything, he would have this one other object. And this is an often told and well-known story. But there's another object which was quite possibly also smuggled out by Marie Bonaparte, and this is this small Chinese jade screen, which is actually here. The actual object is here in the tray in front of me, and you'll have a chance to look at it a bit more closely at the end of the lecture. Now, she didn't take it at the same time, but it seems highly likely that in the spring of 1938, that's before Freud left Vienna, she also put this in her handbag and smuggled it out with her. Because it can be seen in a photograph of Freud in London, taken in London before his objects all arrived. He left Vienna on the 4th of June 1938, and his objects didn't arrive in London until the 15th of August 1938, but this little jade screen was already here. So I think we're entitled to say that this mattered a lot. This mattered a great deal to Freud. Here we have this situation where a man has this large collection of things that he has loved and cherished and handled and has meant a vast amount to him over his life. And faced with the possibility of losing it all and with the possibility of being able to only save two things, one of the things he saves is the bronze Athena, and the second thing that he decides to save is this small jade screen. And I would argue, therefore, that this gives us grounds for saying that the Chinese objects matter to Freud in a way which is out of all proportion to their actual numbers in the collection. The Chinese part of the collection is absolutely not as large as the bulk of the collection, which is made up of Roman, Greek, and Egyptian objects, that is, objects from the ancient Mediterranean world. So the Chinese objects are numerically few by comparison, but I think we can say something about their importance. Because if we look a bit more closely, not only is this the object that he smuggled out, and here's a picture of Marie Bonaparte with Freud, and I'll come back to this lady and her importance. She's also present for us here in the room through the kindness of the curators of the Freud Museum. I'll come back to the importance of this figure later. But if we look at his desk with this object on it, what we can see, let's see if I can make it a bit more obvious to you. Yeah. So here we've got this object. Here's Athena, and here's another Chinese object. Another Chinese object. It looks like this. It's a small jade figure on a wooden stand. I think it's probably part of the inlay for a large object, a screen or a casket or something. It's not a freestanding, it wouldn't stand up by itself. It's not a freestanding jade figure. So the Athena is literally sandwiched in between two Chinese objects. And it is two Chinese objects which are in Freud's line of vision as he sits at his desk. These are the things that are literally right in front of his face as he sits at his desk. And I think therefore, And here's the arrangement of the desk as it was in Berggasse when these photographs were taken. You can see the little, here's the jade screen. The Athena's already gone. The Athena's already disappeared because she's been taken away by Marie Bonaparte. Here's Freud in Paris, en route for London, with just a few objects, often objects that had been bought on the way or given to him by friends on the way. So the desk is rather sparse, and I find it rather hard to make out what these particular objects are. And it's quite hard to relate them. But when he eventually gets to London, his desk was arranged for him by the family's devoted maid, Paula Fichtel. And Freud wrote to one of his friends on the 8th of October 1938, "All the Egyptians, Chinese and Greek women have arrived, have stood up to the journey with very little damage and look more impressive than in Berggasse." Now, I think there are a couple of interesting things about this quote. One, Egyptians, Chinese and Greek are all sort of given the same status. They're all kind of equivalent and important. I find, of course, it's very difficult when talking about Freud not to kind of make a lot out of little things, but the bearded figure of the immortal that is immediately in front of his face is very clearly not a woman because of the beard. And so he's seeing these all as women. And interestingly, he's seeing them as women, not as statuettes of women. He talks about them, as collectors often do, don't they? Collectors talk about the things they own as if they were members of the family or friends or lovers. And in that regard, I think, you know, Sigmund Freud might be one of the towering geniuses of 20th century thought, but his behaviour around his collection is in many interesting ways rather similar to a broad range of collectors. And so one of the things I want to talk about this afternoon is the way in which this extraordinary man who wrote these extraordinary books and had these extraordinary ideas, how he does and does not fit into the pattern of the collector. So what I want to talk about is, what is the place, literal and metaphorical, of Chinese objects in Freud's collection of antiquities? And as I say, this is not a topic that has been studied very much by comparison with Freud. When people write books called Freud and Antiquity, they are books about Freud and the Greco-Roman world, or Freud and the ancient Egyptian world. But I want to stress again this kind of visibility of the Chinese collection to Freud. It not only matters to him, but it's very visible to him. So we have these objects on the desk, and as you would see, if you want, and I hope you will go downstairs and look, the line of objects on the shelf immediately in front of Freud's desk includes a number of his Chinese objects, including this white marble Buddha head, which is also in the room with us today. Now, it seems, and this is a fairly preliminary stage of research, that although Freud had been collecting antiquities from his youth and really from as soon as he could, you know, as soon as he had a job that provided him with a salary sufficient to buy things, that he started buying Chinese things relatively late. He seems to have acquired a lot of his Chinese art, and I'll give you some details on this, relatively late on in his life. We know that when he was in New York in 1909, he bought a Buddha, what is described as a Buddha bust. I'm not entirely sure which one in the collection that is. Interestingly, he bought it from Tiffany's, that is the New York high-end jeweler and interior decorator, you know, which reminds us that in 1909 we're not always talking about a kind of infrastructure of specialist dealers in Asian art, but we might be dealing with, he bought it from Tiffany's. Of course, there's another collection, a connection with Tiffany's, in that Dorothy Tiffany Burlingame was Anna Freud's companion and collaborator through a great deal of her life. So that's the shelf of things that is directly in front of Freud's line of view. And I also want to introduce another theme, which is that And I'm perfectly prepared to be shouted down by people in the room who know more about this than I do, but I don't think that is much older. I think that was pretty new when he bought it. I don't think that's an object of any great antiquity. Whatever it was sold to Freud as, it was essentially a new object at the time that he bought it. So we know relatively little about how Freud acquired the Chinese objects, which are here in the museum now, but we don't know nothing. And one of the great sources that we have is what Freud called his Kürzeste Chronik, his shortest chronicle. This is a diary which Freud kept from 1929 down to his death in 1939, which has in it very, very brief entries to do with things like appointments, you know, who came to see him, who he met, who he kind of dealt with. It's extremely... it's extremely brief. So, you know, you get an entry like 1930, March, Tuesday the 4th, Jade bought. It's not now possible, or I think in the present state of our understanding, it's not possible to tie individual jades in the collection to say, well, this is the one he bought on the 4th of March, 1930. Nor does he say who he bought it from, nor does he say what he paid for it, which are all things that we would be kind of extremely interested to know. But I think we can know something we can make a pretty good guess about where he bought some of these things. He bought a great deal of things from an antiquities dealer in Vienna called Robert Lustig, who dealt not specifically in Chinese things, but in all kinds of antiquities. And we certainly know that Freud, there are entries in the shortest chronicle which just say Lustig, i.e., which suggests that he went to Lustig's gallery and just maybe had a look around and maybe he didn't buy anything then. But it seems highly likely that some of the things come from Lustig, and Lustig was not particularly a specialist in Chinese art. I need to be in touch with people in Vienna working on the history of the art market in Vienna, which is work that I know is going on, and I think it will be possible to get a better sense, and I'd be very interested to hear from people here. I know there are colleagues from Vienna present. I'd be very interested to hear what is known about the kind of the state of dealing in non-Western art in Vienna in the years from 1929 to 1939, which are the years covered by the shortest chronicle. It is possible, I think, to tie certain things to objects that are now in the collection. So it seems a fairly good guess that Chinese woman rider, which is what he writes for the 5th of February 1932, is in fact this object, which you can see downstairs. There are a large horse bought, it says, for the 28th of June 1932. And there are a couple of horses in the collection. It could be that one. It could be either of those. I don't see any way. And the state of the Freud was a private collector. He wasn't a museum, and therefore he didn't keep the kinds of records that would enable us to pin these things exactly to it. Iron Buddha. Is this Iron Buddha head, which is in the collection, is that the Iron Buddha that he bought on the 17th of February 1933, or is it one of the other kind of small iron figures in the collection? Both are perfectly possible, it seems to me. Some entries from 1935. 26th of June, 26th of April, counterpiece to Yellow Dragon. 5th of September, Jade, Bowl and Camel. 1st of October, Large Canon. That's kind of interesting that he's using that Japanese terminology, Guanyin, of course, in Chinese, for European collectors right across Europe, so German-speaking, French-speaking, English-speaking, the term Canon, the Japanese pronunciation of Guanyin, is how this particular Buddhist figure is known. And then the 3rd of December 1935, Anna 40 Years Lodge Hand Box. Anna is, of course, Anna Freud, Freud's, you know, most beloved daughter and in some ways kind of intellectual successor. And again, I think it tells us something about the importance of Chinese things to Freud that he should give Anna Chinese antiquities for her birthday. I think it's highly likely that this is the large hand box that is meant, that he gave Anna for her 40th birthday. And it's actually on display in that glass cabinet in the corner there. So if you'd like to have a look at that, afterwards, please do. Is this the large Canon? This is certainly the largest Guanyin figure in the... This is the largest figure, one of the largest Buddhist figures in the collection. Maybe this is it. I don't think we can be kind of entirely sure. And you know, this is the kind of thing that goes, that goes right through it. It's possible to go through the shortest chronicle as I've done and abstract all the references to works of Chinese art. You know, they just say. Acquisitions camel driver, Jade. I think the camel driver, which is on the 13th of November 1931, might well be the figure of a groom, which is next door in Anna Freud's room, which is this well-known, I didn't make a slide of it, but this well-known Tang figure type of a Central Asian groom, very explicitly foreign features with the large curly beard and the large hooked nose, a very kind of standard type of Tang figure. I think that might well be the camel driver. But so it goes on. Iron Buddha, painted Chinese lady, Buddha head, dwarf figure and jade for Dorothy, ivory Buddha and stone dog of Fo. I got very excited when in among this I noticed on the 16th of July 1934 he just says Chinese lectures. And I got very excited about this. This is Freud kind of going to lectures about Chinese art. What that actually refers to, and again the book is here, is the arrival on Freud's desk in that day in 1934 of a copy of the first Chinese translation of Introductory Lectures to Psychoanalysis, which kind of reminds us that even at this period, there's a connection between Freud. You know, Freud is a figure to Chinese intellectuals in the Republican period, and his work is beginning to be discussed and translated, and I find this rather exciting. Freud's own copy of the Chinese edition of Introductory Lectures to Psychoanalysis is also there on the table for us to have a little look at. So, one of the things that will have been sort of dawning on people is the presence in the collection of a very large number, a high proportion, of what we might call recent pieces, or what we might more unkindly call fakes. So the issue of kind of where he got the material from, and so on. Now we know that Freud's attitude to fakes was harsh in the sense that he did not keep, if he acquired something and subsequently discovered it was a fake, he got rid of it. He didn't wish to keep, he wasn't the kind of person who thought, well, it's interesting to keep these fakes for study or comparative purposes. He got rid of them from his Greek and Roman bronzes or his Egyptian figures. So one of the things that I find kind of very curious along with this is what we might know about, what did Freud know about Chinese art? We can say something quite specific about what Freud owned, but when we get to the question of what did Freud know, it becomes more difficult. And there are several problems in this. One of the first of them is that Freud seems to have gone out of his way almost to ignore the scholarship on Chinese art generally. despite the fact that Germany, or the German-speaking world, was very much the centre of Western scholarship on Chinese art in his lifetime. And I'm just showing an example. These are from a couple of auction catalogues from the Hugo Helbing auction house. Annotated copies of these telling us who bought what and what they were selling. Annotated copies of all Helbing auction house catalogues are now being digitized by the Central Institute for Art History in Munich, and I think will be an extraordinary resource for studying the collecting of Chinese art as well as the collecting of many other kinds of art. So Germany, the German-speaking world, was the center of our center of dealing in this kind of material, but also a center of scholarship. And I'm showing you a photograph of a man kind of very important to me in my present job, William Cohn, Wilhelm Cohn, as he was born, was a student of Heinrich Wolflin's at the University of Berlin. He was keeper of Asian art at the Berlin Museum in the 1930s. He was dismissed from his job in 1933 when the Nazis came to power. He managed to come to Britain as a refugee, and he was the first keeper of Eastern art at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, where there's still a William Cohn lecture in his honour. He was also the editor of Ostasiatische Zeitschrift, which was the main kind of scholarly journal for the study of East Asian art in the interwar period, and which in terms of the quality of its scholarship is very much higher, in my view, than material being published, in English at this time. But Freud, who, let us remember, was a voracious reader, and who in 1931 wrote to the author, the novelist Stefan Zweig, and said, "I have actually read more archaeology than psychology." Freud appears to have had no contact with this world of scholarship on Chinese art, despite him at this point upping the pace of his acquisitions in Chinese art. Freud's library, which has been extensively studied, contains almost no books about Chinese art. And that's very striking by comparison with the large number of books he owned on ancient Roman, Greek, Egyptian art. So Freud certainly had Friedrich Brzezinski's von China's Goethen, which is an art history book, it's a sort of travel book about China. He owned Bachhofer's Chinesische Kunst, Chinese art, with this wonderful kind of Weimar Republic cover. He owned a couple of books in English. He owned Una Pope Hennessy's Early Chinese Jades, which was published in 1923, but I have my suspicions that this might be something that was added to the library here after he came to Britain. And he owned, towards the very end of his life, Hurley Glessner Creel's The Birth of China. But that's it. That's all there is. There are only this very, very small number of books. So he turned for information on Chinese art, and his main informant seems to have been Hans Demel. Hans Demel was director of the Egyptian Oriental Collection of the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna. He was himself a specialist in Egyptian art. Now, there are also Egyptian fakes in the collection as well, so the quality of Demel's connoisseurship, there has to be a kind of question over that. Freud clearly liked and trusted Demel, who wrote authentication notes for Freud, a very few of which still exist here in the museum. And Freud definitely, at the end of his life, felt that he owed Demel a great deal, as Demel, he felt, had deliberately undervalued the collection financially in order to make it easier for Freud to take it out of Austria. Demel valued the collection in May 1938 at 30,000 Reichsmarks, and that's £2,400 in sterling at that time, which is a lot of money. I mean, it's still a very, very big sum of money. But Freud felt that Demel had done him a favour, and that Demel had and behaved very decently, had helped him out by depressing artificially the value of the collection. So there's no sense that he felt that Daimel had, that he didn't trust Daimel or that Daimel's connoisseurship was in any way suspect. I think actually we're just dealing here with a very relatively low level of knowledge among knowledgeable or Europeans who thought of themselves as knowledgeable. I don't think Robert Lustig was deliberately selling Freud fake tongue horses. I don't think that Daimel was deliberately authenticating fake tongue horses. I think that all three of them thought that this was a tongue horse. Things have moved on now, but let's not be too snooty about the past. Let's worry more about the mistakes we're making now than the mistakes people made in the past. There's some interesting additions to the collection. This figure, which is in the basket here, and its companion, which are right again in Freud's line of sight on Freud's desk. We know that these were, when Freud arrived sort of bereft of his collection, we know that Marie Bonaparte bought these for him on the London art market, as a welcome present to cheer him up. We don't know who she bought them from. Blewett's Sphinx, there were a number of specialist dealers in London, of which Blewett's was probably the most famous at this time. We don't know where she bought them, but we do know that she bought these in London to add to them. There's an interesting episode as well that there they are on Freud's desk. An interesting episode as well in that Freud's arrival in London has a curious connection with a very famous figure in the collecting of Chinese art, and that's Sir Percival David. And this discovery was made by Stacey Pearson of the School of Oriental and African Studies, who discovered this letter from Percival David to Fritz Sapsel, director of the Warburg Institute in London. Percival David was already at this point beginning to suffer the first symptoms of the neurological disease which eventually killed him. But these were the very beginning symptoms, and there was some sense these might be psychological. And it's clear from the letter that Sachsel had offered, I mean, Freud intended to work when he came, to take patients when he came to London. And it's clear that Percival David thought he might go and, or Sachsel said, well, why don't you go, he's the most famous psychoanalyst in the world, your problems might be psychological, why not go and see him? But Percival David writes back, so although, I don't think my problems are psychoanalytic, he was dead right, this was a neurological degenerative disease he was suffering from. So although I shall be delighted to meet so eminent a person as Dr. Freud in a social way, I don't think I should be justified in taking up his professional title. At some later date, if he is well enough to go out, I should much like to show him over my collection, since I know he is interested in Chinese art. And that's a very kind of interesting thing, which means that when Freud arrived in Britain in 1938, someone like Percival David already knew about his interest in Chinese art. I have no idea how that information got to Percival David, but Percival David was quite right about that. Now, of course, the Chinese art that Freud was interested in and the Chinese art that Percival David was interested in are two completely different things. It's a wonderful... It's almost like a mini play. Freud visits the Percival David collection. We're going to write this as a two person one act play, because the kind of things that serious European collectors of Chinese art are getting very excited by, Song ceramics, monochromes, even the beginnings of kind of serious interesting early blue and white. The sort of things that make the Percival David collection, one of the most famous collections of Chinese ceramics in the world, are utterly different from the aesthetic of the kind of things that Freud liked. So, he's both known as a collector of Chinese art, and as I've underlined, I have no idea how Percival David knew that Freud, who had just arrived in Britain, and it's obviously a huge celebrity, this is very big news, there are newsreels. Freud broadcasts on the radio, there's a The only sound we have of Freud's voice, rather poignantly, is him speaking in English on a recording, a brief recording made for the BBC, which you can find quite easily on YouTube. But we don't know what Freud sounded like in his native German, but we know what Freud sounded like speaking in English. So he's very much not interested in the kind of plots. But we're told here that, you know, I know he is interested in Chinese art. But really, how interested was he? And here I want to come back to this curious paradox of almost deliberately choosing not to know about certain things, which he could quite easily have known about had he wanted to. And I want to push that a little bit further with what might seem like a kind of almost a game, but I think there's one way of thinking about it, because I want to now contrast or compare and contrast Freud with another character who's almost a doppelganger of Freud, a person who has a number of uncanny connections with Freud, but who he never met, and seems similarly never to have known about. And those two people are Sigmund Freud and Mark Oral Stein. Now, if we start to think about, these two men were contemporaries, born within 6 years of one another, and they're essentially both men of the 19th century, in the sense that their ideas were very much developed and formed in the 19th century, even if they both achieved their greatest international fame in the first decade of the 20th century, and both of them lived to witness the terrible cataclysm of war which divided that century in half. Both of them were born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Oral Stein, was born in Budapest, and Freud was born at Freiburg, now in the Czech Republic. And they sort of express its duality, one of them born in the Austrian half of the empire, one of them born in the Hungarian half. Both were Jewish, although they were both strongly rational men without any time for organized religion, and both very hostile to anything that smacked of mysticism. They both had very strong and dominant mothers, and they both had rather weak fathers in the background. They were both British subjects when they died. There's Freud's urn, and here is Stein's much vandalised, rebuilt again, and Stein's grave in Kabul, the capital of Afghanistan. As I say, both of them died British, even though both of them had family members who fought for the Austro-Hungarian Empire in the First World War. Both of them, as boys, were absolutely obsessed with the ancient world, and in particular with Alexander the Great. Both of them had what you can really only call an Alexander the Great fetish. They were, of course, both explorers of the unknown. They weren't necessarily... There are, as well as these parallels, of course, there are obvious differences. One of them was very much a family man, one of them very much a loner. They both had older mentors who were extremely important in their lives, Joseph Boyer for Freud and Pandit Govind Kaul for Stein. Both of them had devoted followers. They were both very good at getting other people to do things for them. I'm showing you here Florence Mary Glenn Lorimer's Oral Stein's the recording angel, as Stein called her, who did all the very hard work. And here, by comparison, is Freud and the committee in 1922, his closest Praetorian guard of true believers and followers. Both had rivals, or perceived rivals, for preeminence in their field. Paul Pelliot for Stein, Carl Jung for Freud. And they both existed in a 19th, early 20th century model of scholarship in which the Congress, the meeting, the gathering were extremely important. Here's the first International Congress of Psychoanalysts in Salzburg in 1908, and the 7th International Congress of Orientalists in Vienna. Now, this kind of scholarship can take over your mind and drive you down some kind of really weird paths. We know that, so I have to kind of rein myself in at this point. The point at which I said enough is enough of this, in a way, is when I became obsessed with the fact that the 7th Congress of Orientalists was held in Vienna in the year in which Freud was married. So I have this kind of image of, you know, them passing one another on the streets of Vienna, and not really. We know they were both in Vienna at the same time. But there's absolutely no evidence that they have all met. But the focus of their interest, and this I think is kind of interesting, which bit of China's enormously long past are they most interested and associated with? Stein, of course, obviously with Dun Huang and with the Tang Dynasty. And it's from the Tang Dynasty, although he never uses the word Tang Dynasty in the Shortest Chronicle, it's from the Tang Dynasty that most of these things come. So both of them, both of them experienced serious surgery. Stein lost his toes to frostbite in 1907. Freud endured the removal of his jaw for cancer of the jaw. But I think more seriously, they both dug deep. They both dug deep and found what most confirmed their most deeply held beliefs. In Freud's case, about the centrality of sexuality in human life. And in Stein's case, the extension of Western civilization deep into Asia. For one of them, archaeology was a practice. For the other one, it was a supremely powerful metaphor. Who might they have? So they didn't know one another. And Stein's books are nowhere visible in Freud's library. Who might they have known in common? Did they, are there degrees of separation? Did they know anybody in common? I think the best bet for somebody they knew in common was Emmanuel Loewy. Emmanuel Loewy was Freud's boyhood friend, a professor of archaeology and art history in the German Institute in Rome. There's a very sweet piece of film, which you can see on YouTube, silent film, of Freud and Loewy in conversation. They had been friends since they were little boys, and these two kind of old men gathering together for a birthday party is extremely sweet. So, it's not impossible, I haven't gotten there yet, but it's quite possible that professionally Stein and Loewy might have met one. But I want to stress, there's a lot of this going on, this interest in, and I give you in particular this title of Albert von Lecoq's Auf Heller Spuren in Ostturkestan, On the Tracks of Greece in Eastern Turkestan. Now, if there was one thing that Freud was deeply interested in, it was the tracks of Greece. But he seems, again, not to have known, it's hard to believe that he didn't know some of this stuff because, he read the newspapers, and that's one thing I need to go into and kind of look at coverage of this in the newspapers. But Stein is part of a much larger enterprise which is very much centred on the German speaking world. But Freud didn't own the books. Did he know about Pelio, von Lecoq, either through books or exhibitions? It seems almost impossible that he didn't, but there's almost no visibility. And that becomes, I think, more extreme when you read this. This is a very famous passage from Freud's writings. Imagine that an explorer arrives in a little-known region where his interest is aroused by an expanse of ruins with remains of wall, fragments of columns, and tablets with half-effaced and unreadable inscriptions. He may content himself with inspecting what lies exposed to view, with questioning the inhabitants, perhaps semi-barbaric people who live in the vicinity, about what tradition tells them of the history and meaning of these archaeological remains, and with noting down what they tell them, and he may then proceed on his journey. But he may act differently. He may have brought picks, shovels, and spades with him, and he may set the inhabitants to work with these implements. Together with them, he may start upon the ruins, clear away the rubbish, and beginning from the visible remains, uncover what is buried. If his work is crowned with success, the discoveries are self-explanatory. The ruined walls are parts of the ramparts of a palace or a treasure house. The fragments of columns can be filled out into a temple. The numerous inscriptions, which, by good luck, may be bilingual, reveal an alphabet and a language, and when they have been deciphered and translated, yield undreamed-of information about the events of the remote past to commemorate which the monuments were built. Now, it's hard to think of a better description of what Stein achieved in Central Asia than that. This was written in 1896, before Stein had set out on his first, but the idea of the fragments, the half-barbarous inhabitants, the unreadable inscriptions in unknown languages and scripts, this is very much what Stein knew about. And indeed wrote about. So in a way, it almost seems to me that Freud, it almost must have taken an effort of will on Freud's part to not know about this. Now, you could say that, Freud was older, he wasn't reading so much, he wasn't so interested. Except that if we take the really one of the two sensational archaeological discoveries of the early 20th century as far as the English-speaking world is concerned, one would be Stein, but even more than Stein would be Tutankhamun. And we know that Freud, he'd been ill, he was sent a copy of Carter's Tomb of Tutankhamun. The British psychoanalyst Joan Riviere sent him a copy of this. And Freud said, "The other day I received a book which interested me more greatly than anything since I fell ill." This is published Stein was distinctly sniffy about the Tutankhamun excavations. He saw this as just treasure hunting and not serious archaeology and so on. But the fact is, he grabbed Freud's imagination, he devoured the book, he kept the book in his library. His copies of the Tomb of Tutankhamun are still downstairs in his library. So doesn't that make it even sort of stranger that there is no interest in this great archaeological discovery, which is all about the tracks of Alexander the Great, the tracks of Greece in Central Asia, all the kind of things that one might imagine Freud would have been most enormously interested in. Now, you know, we're almost talking here I'm on very thin ice, because as I said before, I'm not, I'm so far from being a specialist on this, but it's almost like a repression. It's almost like knowledge is sort of being repressed. Or in the sense that we're dealing with Freud kind of choosing not to know. Now, this takes me into the territory of Freud and the Other, or to quote the title of Edward Said's important lecture of 2003, Freud and the Non-European. I want to finish by just pointing us in a direction which may seem trivial or may seem flippant, but the more I think about it, the more important I think it is in kind of understanding this mystery. Let's think about Freud's dogs. Freud owned dogs and loved them dearly in the latter part of his life. On the 1st of the 14th of January 1937, so this is, you know, the Nazis are already in power in Germany, Austria is threatened. His dog Yofi, as he often kind of spelled it, died from heart failure. The following day, the Shortest Chronicle says, Thomas Mann, Lund Tegenau. Thomas Mann, of course, great German novelist. Lund was his new child. These dogs were often gifts to him from Princess Marie Bonaparte. She kept chows. And the chow, of course, is very much a breed of dog identified, whether correctly or not, but identified with China, identified in the Western mind with China. I mean, along with the Pekingese, it is the kind of Chinese breed of dog, and the name chow, which has, I think, nothing to do with anything Chinese at all. I haven't really done this work yet on the history of dog breeding. There's been very, very good work on the history of the Pekingese, which are, as a cultural kind of artifact in British culture. But I think it's not uninteresting that these Chinese dogs also have Chinese names or Chinese style names. What Europeans, the kind of names that Europeans who know no Chinese might think sounded like Chinese names. So Yo Fi, often written with two syllables. And I think even more interestingly, Lun. Now, of course, when I think of Lun, I think of Li Lun, the Lun. You know, the idea that Freud owned a dog that was called Theory is almost kind of too good to pass up. Now, I think this is completely, sort of coincidental. I don't think Freud knew what any of these things meant, but the fact that these things, which are so precious to him, I mean, all the accounts of towards the end of his life, he was heartbroken. When these dogs died. You know, these dogs that are identified as in some way Chinese are enormously precious parts of his life. And he tended to give them repeating names. So there was more than one, Lun in his life. Not as far as Stein, who had... Stein had six dogs, all called Dash. He called all of his dogs Dash. Even though they look, they sort of... Dash 5 is the interesting one, because Dash 5 is... Dashes 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6 are kind of clearly all sort of from the same kind of area of the dog world. But he branched out in 1927 and bought a completely different kind of dog, but he still called it Dash. So this led me to think a bit about sort of repetition. What does it mean to repeat something again and again? Of course, very much a theme in Freud's thinking. So if we put these two together, and here is Freud with the two this is Lun one. The first Lun, and Yo Fi, and when Yo Fi died, another child was acquired and also named Lun. So here he is with these dogs. I mean, is it too much to imagine that these dogs, in a way, in Freud's life, China is there, but it's silent. It doesn't speak. Unlike the Greco-Roman world, which speaks to him, and which is an object of kind of engagement and dialogue for him, China is for him silent, and in a way which seems to me to be a kind of choice, and that these dogs which stand for China, it stand for a relationship, even a love, which he either couldn't or wouldn't or didn't want to put into words. Thank you very much for your attention.